We begin a new regular segment on The Exchange today, a segment featuring people telling stories about the recent history of the region, oral histories with artifacts to match in the Southern Oregon Digital Archive at Southern Oregon University. The segment is so new, we haven't agreed on a name for it yet. But we do have a first guest who has stories to tell about the planting of trees on a massive scale in the region in the 70s and 80s, and the planters who were often people from the 60s counterculture. Robert Durning was part of all that and a planting co-op called Green Side Up. He's in the studio with me. Robert, welcome.
Thank you, Jeff.
Pleasure to have you here. Maureen Battistella is here as well. She's the curator of our new segment, and we're still even talking about names for it right now. Maureen, always good to see you.
Good to be here. Thank you, Jeff.
So you are the maintainer of the Southern Oregon Digital Archive?
I would say that I'm a content developer, mm-hmm. a collector of stories of Southern Oregon for the last couple of years. This project actually got started in January thanks to funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Funding to do what specifically?
Funding to go out and talk and listen and collect stories from people from hither and yon, Jackson and Josephine County, small towns everywhere.
That sounds like a fun process for you.
It was amazing.
Mm-hmm. How many different people have you talked to?
Oh, probably about 100. We have taped interviews from about 100 people and photographs, thousands of photographs from their family
histories. I noticed a whole bunch of photographs from did I call you Durning? It's Herning. Yes, of course. I knew I'd get mistaken with Charles Durning. Thank you for that, Robert. So let's talk about how you guys met. Maureen, tell us the story of how you ran across Robert and his efforts.
So we started May, June, July of 2017, and we started putting out notices, story day, story day, story day. And I got this cryptic email, just one line, are you going to be in the Illinois Valley? And we wrote back, yes, of course. We're going to be there on June 24th. And so that was how we met Robert on one of the hottest days of that early summer. So hot. Ice cubes melted in a moment.
So, Robert Herning, tell us about yourself. I mean, you're not originally from the region, but you've been in the region for a long time now.
Yeah, I've lived in Tacoma now. This is be 47 years in May. I came from the east, and I was in the universities and Pittsburgh for an undergraduate years, and I was a graduate in University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. And then I followed the culture, counterculture west to the Bay Area. And then those years of the late 60s and early 70s was a period of that people went back to the land. And I'm not sure exactly why this happened. People were fed up with the war. People were fed up. That's the Vietnam War. People were fed up with the urban sprawl that was going on. And, of course, it's much worse now. But we went back to the land. And I found Tacoma in the spring of 1971 and moved there immediately after hitchhiking in a yellow van.
Had you heard of it from somebody else?
I came in with a guy named Rainbow Bob who I met on a beach somewhere.
Why Tacoma? What was in Tacoma that got people there in the first place? I've often wondered about how.
Well, Tacoma was a town that had gone through boom and bust cycles from the 1850s when gold was discovered at Waldo. The gold ran out. Everybody left.
Let me point out, this is in the Illinois Valley, not far from Cave Junction.
Not far, yeah. It's about 10 miles south of Cave Junction. And then copper was very prevalent in the mountains on the other side of the valley, and there was another boom for copper around the First World War era for making armaments, I'm sure. And then that all ran out, and then people left. And then they all came back and logged the place, and then they cut the trees down and left, and we found it. And
so,
it was pretty empty then.
Was it really? Okay, so give us a sense of what you saw when you looked around the landscape of Southern Oregon in 1971, right?
Well, one of the things you would have noticed immediately was shaved mountains. I think historically I need to go back a little bit, but there were some laws that changed the Forest Service relationship to logging. And the Sustained Yield Multiple Use Act of 1960 changed things tremendously. And what that specified was what was the idea, at least, is there should be a sustained flow of timber. And that logging that took place would be replaced by tree planting. And so they accelerated timber cutting after that during the 60s, and particularly during the 70s. The sustained yield part of this was supposed to be that there would be a perpetual flow of timber, so that as they cut it down, other trees would be growing.
And that the cycle would perpetuate,
right.
So you'd never be unable to sell timber from there.
Each ranger district had the maximum amount that could be cut every year. It was called the allowable cut. This was turned topsy-turvy and became the minimum that had to be cut. And every ranger in every ranger district was responsible for cutting that minimum. And as you looked around the landscape at that time, I remember the first time I saw one of these clear cuts. And I went, oh, do they really know about what's going on here? And, of course, they did.
Yeah. We're talking to Robert Herning here on the Jefferson Exchange on our new segment of Oral Histories. He was part of a commune in Tequilma and part of a reforestation planting effort that went on for quite a few years in southern Oregon based in that area. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange with Robert and Maureen Battistella, who's our curator for the segment, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Yeah, even when I had gotten here in the mid-'80s, there were issues like the Rogue River National Forest saying, well, we don't think we can sustain 214 million board feet a year anymore. And the timber industry said, what? You've got to keep cutting that until you get better information, at which point they said, we think we can cut 137 a year, which was far less. And then, of course, with the spotted owl and the Northwest Forest Plan, it was more like about 40 million board feet a year.
Actually, the spotted owl and Northwest Forest Plan were about 10 years after the collapse of the timber industry because of other reasons that occurred. But let me go forward and then get to that point, because that's pretty much when the story of Greenside Up ended in the mid-'80s. Mm-hmm. The Forest Service, and as I look now in this perspective, that we thought we were coming into something that had been ongoing for a long time, but really the Forest Service had not experienced a continual cycle of growing trees, cutting trees, growing trees. This was all new, and they were trying to accelerate timber production by doing all sorts of things that there was the spraying program, and they didn't really understand how the trees that were planted would eventually turn out to be timber. So we were planting trees that didn't belong in that place at all, or maybe the ones that had been cut off there but wouldn't grow on a clear cut in the sun.
Because they needed more shade.
They needed more shade.
Yeah.
So we started out, in fact, the first job I had was with a Chicano contractor. And they recruited a bunch of us that were rather jobless at the time, because that's one of the things that coming back to the land, there wasn't a lot of opportunity for making any money. So we heard about planting trees, and they loaded us into pickup trucks in the winter. Mm-hmm. In the back of pickup trucks and took us up in the mountains, freezing cold, never gave us any instructions. We wandered around in circles, bashing logs and not knowing what we were supposed to be doing.
And I was reading about getting augers stuck on the ground and all the other great things
all
that happened.
All kinds of things happened, but this was particularly this first experience, which was in the fall of 71. And they, of course, told us we'd be making big money, and, of course, we did not make anything very big and hardly made anything at all. But a couple of years later, we were hired by the Forest Service to plant trees as what they called a force account crew. And that was a different experience, that working as a crew for the Forest Service employees, we learned properly how to plant trees, and we were taken up in, of course, enclosed vehicles that weren't freezing cold, and given lunch times, and we learned how to plant. As time went on, we learned later that winter that you could take a contract to plant trees. There were contracts out there. That's what the Chicano's contractors had done.
And the idea was to replace the force account crews, right?
Right. And so we began with a very small contract. We called ourselves New Land Reforestation, and we planted trees, and it was, we didn't really know a great deal about contracting, but we did know about planting trees.
So I understand the Forest Service, from reading your stuff, made it fairly easy to get in as a contractor, didn't they?
Yes, they tried in the beginning to nurture our ability to take contracts and to work as a group. And then as the time went on, they put out more contracts for us and began to realize that we were maybe making more money than they thought we should have. To say the least.
Maureen Battistella wants to come in here.
You know, I wonder, Greenside Up wasn't the only commune working towards reforestation at the time, was it?
Well, at that period of time, that was, we're talking in, right now, I'm talking about the first few years of the 70s. We didn't know about other groups at all.
Right.
But there was an independent invention that had occurred in many communities in the Northwest, from Northern California to the Olympic Peninsula, of the same kinds of people as we were, back to the land, hippies, and the same thing was developed. Now, Forks of Salmon, California, which you may know is in Siskiyou County, a very isolated community, they developed the same thing, pretty much, but with different nuances because they were in California. Camas Valley had a small group, big group out of Eugene called the Hodads.
Hodads.
Big group. And that was a center. That was a nucleus of energy. And actually, we had lots of communications with them as we developed. There were other groups in Northern Oregon. I can't remember the, but I do remember in Bellingham, Washington, and out on the Olympic Peninsula, there were
ENT too, right?
ENT was Ent Forestry. That was Forks of Salmon.
Okay.
That was the group there, and we learned of each other, and we were very excited because we, found life on Mars.
So Greenside Up is what the name of your contracting entity became, right? And Greenside Up, as I understand it, was not necessarily a term of endearment when it was first applied.
No, it was a hippie joke that was told around the local bars by the woods workers in the timber industry about some hippies they had out there planting trees, and every so often a guy would go out and yell Greenside Up, and then they all guffaw about it. So we heard about this joke, and we thought it was pretty funny, too. So we went out there, and every so often somebody would go, Greenside Up! And we'd all laugh about that.
Robert Herning's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He was involved with tree planting in the early 70s in the Illinois Valley and went on to become part of a contracting group living in a commune in the Tequilma area. He is the first guest in our new segment of Oral Histories around the region. Maureen Battistella is the curator in the studio with me as well. 800-838-3760 if you have some thoughts to swap with us. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So not a great deal of respect from the loggers, it sounds like, but...
No, but that we were working in the woods, there was a mutual understanding that that's what we were as woods workers, and they began to accept us. There were times that were hard times between us, but I think that they began to accept us as being workers in the woods. The Forest Service put up bigger contracts, and that we realized that as a community, this is at the beginning, this is before we started going anywhere away from far from home, but on our local district, they put up enough that was winter work for all of us, I mean hundreds of people, to be able to work in the woods planting trees, and this was going to make some wealth for our community that we've never had before. But it was the perils of Pauline to try to get that contract. We had to have a bid bond. We had to scrape together $20,000. And for a bunch of broke hippies at the time, that was not easy.
Mm-mm.
And what finally happened is that a local druggist in Cave Junction loaned us enough money to do that. And that meant somebody there believed in us. I mean, Cave Junction was not accepting at that time.
Of hippies?
Of a bunch of hippies.
Yeah.
Oh, no, that was not very popular. But he was very great, and we really appreciated that. So that enabled us to take this big contract, and we worked all winter on it, and there was a cash flow that came into the community. We soon realized that we could get contracts from other ranger districts. So the Applegate, which was closer to us than any other, we began to work on the Applegate Ranger District. And pretty soon we worked on Ashland and Goose Nest, which is over by Mount Shasta, and then up on the Umpqua, and then we were now camping. Now we were living in the woods. We were not living at home and going out every day. We were living in the woods in the wintertime, and that's a little different. Oh, Butte Falls. Butte Falls was another one. We mm-hmm. started out at Butte Falls. We had a big teepee and a bus, and a bus and a teepee. And the teepee was pouring rain and snow, and the edges of the teepee, it came in closer and closer, and we were at the end of the night, a big pile of people in the middle.
because the snow was weighing on the side.
Yeah, it was weighing on the side, and the water was creeping in from it. So this was not sufficient to get up in the morning and spend the whole day soaking wet, freezing. So we began to develop better and better camps after that.
Maureen?
Well, Robert, one of the amazing things about your story is your collection of photographs that have come into the archives with your story. And so you contributed about 250 images from that period of time. And there are lots of naked people in that photographic archive, and images of those tents and the bus and the mud and the elevation and the slope. It's just an amazing collection of photographs.
I figured at the time, this was kind of what I wanted to do, is I had a little Instamatic, very cheap little Instamatic camera, and I loaded it up with slide film. I mean, this was not a single lens reflex. This was a little cheap old
thing. Yeah, with a...
Yeah. And I put it in the tree bag in a plastic bag and carried it around. But I took those pictures, and I'm so glad I did. And then other people began to give me pictures, too.
And one of the pictures adorns our web entry about this discussion with you. At its peak, I mean, how many people were working on this through Greenside Up? I mean, and over how many different areas?
Well, we probably had, in Greenside Up, we had probably at least 100 people every year in it. Now, that doesn't mean 100 people at a time. But then we began to do partnerships. Once we found our friends in Forks of Salmon in Ent Forestry, we began to do jobs together. We started out with one at Chemult, and we did a job together. We had a small delegation working with them, and we found we really liked each other because we were similar, and here's this large group of people that didn't know each other, and of course, things happen as they do between people when they get together, and we enjoyed the camaraderie, and they had a great camp. They had a really great camp. They had huge tents with floors and cooks and gas lights, and I mean, this was really nice compared to what we were doing. So we went out more and more with them in joint ventures, and we would field crews all regularly of over 50 people, and with their group, we probably had a couple of hundred.
You mentioned in your written history that there was a lot of pot smoking involved in this too.
Oh yeah, it was almost necessary. But actually, it was hard in the rain to keep it lit, so we did a lot of cookies too.
All right, sounds good. Grab your headphones. We have a call here. I want to go to Jeff in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Robert Herning and Maureen Battistella.
Are you talking to Jeff?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Jeff. This is bringing back a lot of memories. I lived on the Salmon River in Northern California, and I started planting trees with ENT, but ant is what we call them,
mm-hmm.
and blackbird commune, and you're right, there was a lot of naked people in those days, and it was quite an adventure sometimes, and I was also a logger. I logged, and I planted trees, whatever came along, and I remember meeting people who said, first thing they would tell you is, oh, I'm from the mud sharks, or I'm from the Hodads. And it was kind of like there was a connection there, uh-huh. you know, with other tree planting groups. And all that kind of went away. And in the 90s, I got a job as a tree planting inspector with Summit Forest, and all the tree planters, except for the inspectors, were Hispanics.
All right, so times had changed. Thanks for sharing the story with us, Jeff. And so Robert, that brings up the question of, like, when did things begin to wind down? I mean, obviously this the scruffy kind of off in the woods every winter kind of thing would get old after a while.
Well, actually, there was more to this because our things crescendoed after the mid-70s. We got in more and more with other groups, and we began to share with the Hodad groups. We began to share with a group up in Bellingham called Mormont Construction. We did a lot of joint ventures, and this probably around 1980, we did a job with Redwood Park with 10 different cooperatives who didn't know each other at all. Mm-hmm. Our only rule was that we had no more than 3 from each one, and we did a major erosion control job for the Redwood National Park in its beginnings to put the roads to bed and to protect the tall trees growth. That's another story in the side.
Those are those wooden conduits that you...
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah, we built all kinds of devices. After they'd sent some heavy equipment in to outslope the roads, then we came in with horse-drawn, because you couldn't get in there with any vehicles anymore, and put in willows and alders to try to protect the Emerald Creek from the tall trees grove at the bottom of it, which was getting buried in gravel.
So compare what you saw when you first arrived in Tequilma in 1971 with the way the hillsides look now.
Well, what you see now is green, and what you saw then was a patchwork of brown. I mean, there was a huge, huge difference. But what happened in the late 70s was that the timber industry bid higher and higher for stumpage. And in the period was called stagflation. It was under the Carter administration, and they bid so high that when the Reagan administration took over, the price of timber collapsed, and they were stuck with these contracts for cutting timber at twice what they could sell them for. And all the mills shut down. This was not the spotted owl, I want to emphasize.
Yeah, this was 10 years
this
before.
This was 10 years before
the
spotted owl.
Big layoffs at the counties, too, because of the O&C funds dropping so sharply.
Everything crashed, and this was 1979 and 80. And by the time 82, 83 rolled around, we had started to work on the backlog of tree planting enough that there wasn't much going on. There was less and less contracts. We were getting older. And then one very critical thing is that the state of Oregon determined that our business structure, which was the same as the HODADs, was no longer viable as a cooperative corporation of self-employed people. We were to be treated as employees, which meant that our wages dropped drastically.
All right, so things changed at that point, and that was kind of the end of that period. But what a fascinating story all through and through. And it's all contained in the Southern Oregon Digital Archives at the Hannon Library at Southern Oregon University, brought in by Maureen Battistella, who's one of our guests here. Robert Herning is the guy who was part of Greenside Up way back in the day. Thanks so much for sharing your story here on this new segment of the Jefferson Exchange.
My pleasure, Jeff. Thank you.